2010, but he couldn't stay out of the spotlight. He came back in 2012 with fresh barbs aimed at, among others, the crop of presidential candidates, one of whom was Mitt Romney.
When people vote for Mitt Romney, and there's going to be a lot of them, they're going to vote for him, but with a certain lack of enthusiasm. That seems to be one of his problems. It just, this kind of lack of enthusiasm. Back in the days of Harry Truman, there was a popular song called I'm Just Wild About Harry. It's a new version. I'm just mild about Romney. Lukewarm in my feelings, it's true. But he is my choice, so I'll lower my voice and quietly say, he'll do. I'm underwhelmed with Mitt Romney. Please don't expect me to swoon. His hair is unmeshed, jeans carefully pressed, and I must confess that I'm not too impressed, and I couldn't care less, but I'll guess I'll be voting for Mitt. Hip, hip. Okay. I guess I'll be voting for, Mitt.
Now, Mark Russell didn't just pick on Mitt Romney. He took aim at all the candidates and continues to find new sources for his barbed wit and musical shenanigans. Some of that will be on display at the Don Gibson Theater in nearby Shelby on Saturday, on May 2nd. And in advance of that, I am happy to say that Mark Russell joins us for the hour. Welcome. Nice to have you with us.
Thank you, Mike. I want everybody to know I will not be doing that Romney song. In Shelby.
It would kind of be pointless.
You know, the least I could have done was pick a key that I could sing in. When you just hear the audio, I mean, the audience is missing the choreography.
That's true.
They're missing the lampshade that I'm wearing on my head. All these little touches get lost on radio.
Well, and somebody forgot to mic the piano in that. I don't
know.
That's
another thing. Well, I always bring somebody in to knock it out of tune.
Well, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for joining us because you're sitting in a studio at NPR, which is over on Capitol Hill or near Capitol Hill, and you live on the whole other side of town, over in Washington D.C. I don't know how you got there. You must have started yesterday afternoon sometime.
I did. We have a problem with our cab drivers. This is a city of Washington D.C. where the tourist and his or her cab driver could both be seeing the city for the first time.
You know, I've done that. I've taken a cab from National Airport to the I can't think of the hotel. The Hilton, the Capitol Hilton, and the guy just had to go up 14th Street Bridge and over across, and he took me all the way over to the Key Bridge, and I thought, what are you doing? What he was doing is running up his fare, is what he was doing.
That's right. Yep. Anyway. Oh yeah, and you. We used to call the cab stand there at the National Airport the Iranian Motor Pool.
You know, you could have built a career telling jokes, any kind of jokes, but you focused on political humor. Is that because you spent most of your adult life in D.C., or is there something about political humor that just suits you well as a person?
No, it was just the proximity. It was just a gig. It was a piano-playing job in a hotel bar just across the street from the Senate office building. And that was it. I mean, if it had been Detroit, I'd have had an act about the automobile business, I suppose. But that was it. And I was playing the piano. And a congressman said, if you want us to pay attention to you, talk about us. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, we have things going on across the street called hearings. Oh, what are they? I mean, that's what a neophyte I was. This is my political science 101. And so I would go over to the hearings And they were investigating the Teamsters Union. They were investigating charges that the CIA had gone down to Cuba and with help of the mafia to knock off Fidel Castro, issues like that. And so they were interrogating a guy from the mob, a guy named Johnny Roselli. And the committee chairman said, Mr. Roselli, they were all Southerners, by the way. The committee chairman said, Mr. Roselli, what is your occupation? He said, Mr. Chairman, I'm a notorious underworld figure and prominent gangland hitman. And I said, and how long have you been with the government? So that was the beginning. And so they would, at 5 o'clock, the hearing would let up, and they'd come across the street. And they would, for the, you know, the evening cocktails, and they would, the Teamsters would be sitting on one side of the room, and the senators and the staff, and they'd be glaring at each other across the across the room. It was very exciting.
Now that takes a particular mind to go to actually do your homework enough to go to a hearing and then sit through the droning, stay awake, and then find the comedy, the humor in that. I mean, I don't know that I could have found the humor in that, or anybody could have found the humor. What is it about you that allowed you to do that?
Well, it was a lack of prior knowledge. I didn't go to college. I stopped telling people I didn't go to college when it dawned on me that nobody was particularly surprised. So I was just coming in fresh. And so I've had people do a sort of a shrink job on me. And they say, well, you make fun. You make fun of a hierarchy. You make fun of authority. And then that goes back to making fun of Sister Mary Teresa when her back was turned in parochial school. And so that... I don't agree with that or disagree with it, but it's probably true.
I don't know how many people, I was trying to think how many comedians use, maybe you don't think of yourself as a comedian, but use a musical instrument. Yeah. Jack Benny would occasionally pull out the violin, but I don't remember, and maybe the Smothers Brothers, they had their guitar and their bass. But other than that, I can't think of anybody but you who
you're very kind, but my goodness, we must bow down and kneel to the father of the piano, Victor Borge.
Of course! I forgot about
him. He was a tremendous, tremendous influence. I actually had lunch with him one time.
Uh-huh.
I mean, can you imagine? Just the two of us, it was wonderful. And he ordered a pot of tea. And the tea came, and when the waiter wasn't looking, Borge took a spoon, and under the table he bent the spoon back. So then he put the bent spoon into the tea, and then he called the waiter over, and he said, "My tea is too hot. Look at what it did to the spoon." So I tried that one time. I was a few years later. My kids were small, and we were in this restaurant, and I took the bent spoon, and the waitress saw me do that and says, "Sir, what are you doing? What are you doing?"
You can't, so they can't catch you in the act.
Didn't work. That's right.
You retired from a long – you've been doing this since the 1950s. When did you actually start? What year? Do you remember?
How did I get my start?
No, when? When did you get your start?
Well, my parents were dating. Well, you didn't want to go back that far.
No.
But yeah, it was during the the tail end of the Dwight D. Eisenhower presidency.
Really?
His nickname was Ike.
Right.
And it's a shame when the Republicans have conventions and conclaves, all they talk about is Ronald Reagan, which is fine, but they leave out Nixon, understandably. But Eisenhower, come on. You ask somebody today who Ike was, and he said, wasn't he married to Tina Turner? And so the Democrats would make fun of Eisenhower because he played golf probably a little too often. Mm-hmm. And it was, looking back, it wasn't that sleepy, but I guess the consensus was they talk about the 50s and how quiet they were. They weren't, but that's the consensus. They were quiet. And so... it was Russell Baker of the New York Times who described the Eisenhower White House as the tomb of the well-known soldier. One of the great quotes.
That is. I've never heard that.
Yeah. Tomb of the well-known soldier.
So you started in the very late 50s and you continued on until 2010 and you retired in 2010 on what you described as a perfect night. You were performing in Chautauqua. Your family was in attendance. Close friends were there.
Yeah.
But 2 years later, you're back on the trail. Was there too much material inside you trying to get out?
Well, not only that, but you just don't stop writing. You don't stop thinking of stuff. And I would continue to write songs for my own amusement. And then the songs would deteriorate, which they do. You write a song on a Monday, and maybe by Friday it turns to vinegar. And so I would do that. And so then the idea was, we'll try it out on people. Well, what do? You're relegated to being an amusing dinner guest. Or you may have you'd be right at the punchline, and then the waiter would come by with the specials. And so that was frustrating. But the line I use, and it's a little early in the morning for this, I suppose, but I retired because when I started doing this years ago, I made a solemn pledge to myself that I would retire should the day ever come when I was expected to write a song about transvaginal ultrasound.
Did that come to pass?
The day came to pass. No. No. And my rhyming dictionary was no help.
No help at all.
No, but I'll tell you, this is a true story. I came out of retirement. You say there's too much material. But the one that did it, and this is almost 3 years ago, a group of congressmen went over to the Middle East. This is a true story. A group of congressmen went over to the Middle East, and they got drunk, and they went skinny dipping in the Sea of Galilee. I said, that's it. I'm coming out of retirement. Can you imagine? They did that. It was a terrible, terrible story.
You know, because you kind of stumbled into this, if you said a few minutes ago that you were playing piano in a bar across the street from the Capitol, and people would stumble in and say, well, if you want us to pay attention, you got to do this. And you started doing that, and boy, did they pay attention. So you didn't set out to do this. So what did you want to do? You were a kid. Your father ran a gas station, right, in the D.C. area?
That's right.
What did you want to do?
I wanted to be a jazz pianist, a la Duke Ellington or Stan Kenton, even Thelonious Monk. You know, I was a pretty hip teenager, and jazz was never mainstream in America. It really wasn't. And I even went further into it with bebop. Bebop was a very sophisticated form of progressive jazz, and it was so far over my head musically. I mean, you know, I'm basically an evening with Mark Russell is an evening of polka music. I mean, I don't really know. Well, it's
not that there's anything wrong with that. But
no, or you know, I with the three chords that I so talented with those three, I'd have been a great Cajun musician as well. But anyway, the bebop, and so that's what I wanted to do. I mean, I'd go to jazz concerts. I'd get there. I have Ella Fitzgerald's autograph. I have Louis Armstrong's autograph.
Wow.
I mean, I just loved it, which is why I spent 8.5 years in high school.
Mark Russell is with us, a political satirist who will be appearing on Saturday night in Shelby at the Don Gibson Theater. We have a whole hour. This is just a delight. So we're going to take a break and come back, and I get to have more fun. Stay with us. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Blumenthal Performing Arts, presenting an evening with the Doobie Brothers, performing their classic hits and new Nashville-based music, May 5th at Belk Theater, tickets at blumenthal.org. And Bradley Arendt, Bolt Cummings, LLP, a full-service law firm serving the construction industry in Charlotte and throughout the nation, partnering with clients through all phases of a project. Details at babc.com. You know, we talk a lot about urban development in Charlotte and saving the city's striking tree canopy on this program, but we rarely talk about the fact that Charlotte has a substantial number of residents we would refer to as wildlife. And evidently, we're taking pretty good care of them because the National Wildlife Federation has certified our city as a community wildlife habitat. What does that mean? We're going to find out tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, troubling questions remain about the recent death of a 25-year-old black man while in Baltimore police custody. Maryland's governor supports a bill that would require police to wear body cameras. The ongoing debate over police accountability, victims' rights, and citizen privacy.
From 10 to noon on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is Mark Russell, An Evening with Mark Russell, May 2nd at the Don Gibson Theater in Shelby is coming your way, an opportunity to see him perform live. You've probably seen him for years on those countless PBS specials that he did, but I want to go back to the beginning of all this because you wanted to be a jazz musician.
That's right.
But you were also, in your past, a class clown, as many people were, but a lot of class clowns do not get up on a stage and make a success out of their lives as a result of that. Was there something else in your background that propelled you to into this area? Because nobody else in your family was a performer, were they?
No, they weren't, but they were very supportive. I mean, my parents would take my brother and me to nightclubs on school nights.
Wow.
Now, that may be... Wow. It'd be shocking. It doesn't speak well of my parents, but they were supportive. They loved it. And the whole idea, I mean, of having my brother's a professional musician here in D.C.
Oh.
And so, yeah, it came out. But I got lousy grades. I probably made the mistake of going to this very, very strict Jesuit high school in Buffalo. I had a couple of friends who went there, and they
Canisius.
Made it sound like... That's right. They made it sound like so much fun. Well, they were guys getting good marks, but I shouldn't have gone. But and the Jesuit education with the mandatory 4 years of Latin, how would that prepare somebody to be a political satirist? Well, the two Latin phrases, quid pro quo and nolo contendere, which come up in a lot of political stories. The quid pro quo, the lobbyist.
You could translate. Yeah.
Ask me to translate.
So you went to a
quid pro quo. I mean, I'll scratch your back if you scratch my back. Yeah.
You went to a Jesuit that Jesuit high school, Canisius, up in Buffalo, and then you went into the Marine Corps.
That's right.
Which was tougher, the Marine Corps or the Jesuits?
Jesuits.
I thought maybe so.
Boot camp was a piece of cake after the nuns. If my eighth grade teacher were alive today, her name would be Sister Mary Tony Soprano.
and which of those institutions made you skeptical enough to do what you do now? Because part of your humor is skepticism. That's
where
it comes from.
Yeah, and this is, again, political science 101. As an enlisted man in the Marines, a private, later PFC, and then back to private again, which we won't go into. But we would complain, and we would squawk about, why do we have to do this? Why do we have to do that? And the sergeant or the lieutenant would say, you're not supposed to know the big picture. And that stuck. That stuck. And from that day on until today, I'm still trying to find out the big picture. I haven't gotten there yet, but that's what I've been dedicated to. The other thing was, they would say to us, now this is in the early 50s, Harry Truman was president, and they would bawl us out. You guys, you worthless guys, you blah, blah, blah. And they say, you're like a bunch of Democrats. You can't stand prosperity. I vaguely understood what that meant. Later on, I realized that the military, and particularly the Marine Corps then and now, they're predominantly Republicans. Now, in the case of the Marine Corps, the reason they're Republicans and the reason this has been handed down is because Harry Truman, a Democrat, tried to abolish the United States Marine Corps.
I never knew that. Really?
Yeah, it was in 1947. The Great National Defense Act, which created the CIA, it created the General Chief of Staff and the NSA. It was a huge, huge bill following World War II. And as part of that, Truman said, well, why do we need the Marine Corps? We got the Army, we got the Navy. And the Marines never forgot that. Mm. And so but that's what he meant. You're like a bunch of Democrats. You don't know when you have it good. So that there was a political aspect to that, the Marines. I wasn't aware of it at the time, But I could see it now, looking back. Well, yeah, that's what they meant.
You know, since I grew up in Washington, I knew about the Shoreham Hotel and the Blue Room. I think it was the Blue Room at the Shoreham, and I think they had another room where entertainers performed. It was kind of a supper club atmosphere. And
well, I was in the other room. Okay. I was in the cheap, no cover, no minimum.
You were
no,
in the lounge.
True. The Blue Room. I was a lounge lizard. Do you remember that wonderful? There were two satires of a lounge entertainer. One was Lily Tomlin, mm-hmm. and then on Saturday Night Live, Bill Murray did this smarmy
Star Wars
smarmy lounge entertainer.
Yes.
So
that was
me.
Not you. Come on. So when you since you started in a little bar in Capitol Hill just to play the piano, how long did it take you to get to the Shoreham? And
3 years.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
The meteoric. Owner of the
the owner of the Shoreham came into this little bar, and I was thrilled because the Shoreham at the time was the hotel. It'd be unimaginable to even work there.
Yeah.
And so I went there. And, yeah, I was in the lounge. And
wow.
So no cover, no minimum.
But they booked some big people in the Shoreham in those days.
In the Blue Room, like a big vibe, all the big names.
Yeah, people like Peggy Lee, you know.
Yes.
She saw
yes.
your act. She wrote the song, Is That All There Is?
Yeah.
That- Ba-dum-bum.
Yeah.
Oh, God. but I would imagine, though, at that time, and probably to this day, you are the only resident comedian in town. I mean,
which makes me suspect.
I mean, people
see,
would come through,
that's
but
the
you,
thing.
You stayed there, and people kept coming back. That takes a great deal of material.
Yeah, but that meant I was safe. See, I'm sort of analyzing this.
No.
So that's what they said. Well, he's so cozy there, and he hobnobs with these guys, and I did. But the thing is. Then I lost them. They would not turn up in the audience if they were indicted that day.
Was it difficult to perform in front of the people that you were making fun of?
They would be upset, but they wouldn't show it.
Right.
But their fans would be upset. They would where they were really sensitive and really touchy. If I was calling attention to them, calling them out in their own hometown, which I would do. I would travel. I still do. And so now, if I'm in the guy's hometown and he's sitting up there at the head table, and I would say something like, "Well, I I see you wear your older suits here," you know, and so that would be hurtful. See, and so you had to measure that. Are you going to do that? How well do I know the guy? How well will he take it? And I mean, there was one congressman who was no longer with us, but he was a hellraiser in Washington. I mean, he was notorious for just being out on the town all of the time, heavy drinking and all that. And I got to know him. And one time I was with him in his hometown, and my goodness, he's very straight-laced, and he'd meet me, "Well, how do you do? Nice to see you. Lovely to see you." And the night before, he's standing on the table, and so you wouldn't call attention to that. That's the way it was.
In those days, would Democrats and Republicans socialize? Would they come together to watch you perform? When you went to parties in Washington, were they together, or were they as polarized behind the scenes as they are today in front of the scenes?
They weren't as polarized as they are now. The togetherness sometimes is exaggerated. You hear this story about how cozy Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill were. Tip O'Neill was Speaker of the House, gregarious fellow, jovial Irishman, and as was Reagan. And the sort of cliche these days is, well, they'd have a beer every night. No. They had a beer once a year, St. Patrick's Day. That's when they had their beer. And so the idea, they would play cards. Nixon and some Democrats would play poker.
Hmm.
And those were known. And so it was more jovial. But today, no, they brag to their constituents back home about how detached they are in Washington, yeah. D.C. Mm-hmm. Some of them even go so far as to sleep in their offices. They do not have they don't have an apartment.
Right.
They live in their offices. So that's silly. I mean, you know, you knock yourself out, you spend millions of dollars, send me to Washington, D.C. so you can go there and tell the folks back home how much you hate the place.
Yeah. It is strange, isn't it? You know, at the height of your popularity, and we're talking, by the way, to Mark Russell, who's coming to the Don Gibson Theater in Shelby on Saturday night. One show only. At the height of your popularity, you were performing live around the country. You were producing and starring in numerous PBS specials. You kept PBS alive. You appeared frequently on Meet the Press. You were writing newspaper columns. Do you still write that column, by the way?
No, okay. No, I don't. I have things on my website again.
Yes,
I have to keep writing all the time, right. But that's where it is.
You did comedy albums. You wrote a book. Yep. When you look back,
I did radio. I did NBC radio.
Monitor?
No, it was. Well, it was NBC radio.
Yeah.
I did a couple of minutes a day.
Okay. And yeah. Before we started, you told me that you worked with my friend Bill Trumbull, who was on WMAL for years in Washington.
Yeah, he was a household name in Washington, and we had a wonderful time. I just ran into – he had a partner named Chris Core.
Yes,
I ran into Chris the other day. And so Trumbull was a great, great wit. And a dedicated radio personality, mm-hmm. And we had a new sponsor one time. It was a family-oriented billiard academy. And so we were chatting about this, how the idea of the sleazy pool room is no longer.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so wholesome now, the families and everything, and clean and nice, and not like the tawdry, smoke-filled, cigar-chomping pool room. And Trumbull said, well, they're not so wholesome. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, the other day, I think we lost the sponsor because of it after one. He said, the other day I was over at the new billiard hall and I engaged three little old ladies in a game and I beat them and they took me out behind the place and broke my thumbs. So they canceled
that's
the next
Bill.
Day. I'll tell you another story about sponsors canceling after one night. And this was when Johnny Carson was still in New York, and the Carson and the other guy would do a lead into a commercial.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had a brand new sponsor, Smucker's Jelly. And very happy with this. So Carson does the lead-in. And he says, well, we have a new sponsor tonight. We'd like to welcome them to the show, Smucker's Jelly. And then he does the slogan, with a name like Smucker's, it's got to be good.
Mm-hmm.
And then he said, and with a name like Smucker's, it better be. And they canceled.
And <that's> oh, gosh. So at the height of your popularity, when you were doing all this stuff, was it invigorating? Was it exhausting? Were you just beside yourself because you were so successful and so ubiquitous? What was it like for you back then?
Well, I can't believe I did all those things at the same time. And all that traveling, I think I hit my peak there in 2000. I played 100 cities, so that's over 200 days mm-hmm. on the road. I did not handle airport anger management very well. And I can't believe it. One year my luggage was lost 14 times.
Huh.
The airlines were terrible. And so I did it all. I can't believe I did it. And then I think, did I do this joke yet? And you're trying out new stuff on the run, on the fly. And I just did it. I can't believe I did it. And then when I was at the Shoreham, the first show of the evening was 10:30. I'm in bed by then.
That's right.
10:30. And I just can't believe it.
Yeah. How did your PBS career start? Because you really were the doo-wop of your day. Because they raise money now with doo-wop shows. Back then, they raised money with you. So how did it all start?
Well, I was at the Shoreham. I had been there for about 14 years.
Uh-huh.
And the whole Watergate situation consumed my act. I remember the whole show was about Watergate and all the ramifications about that. And some guys from the public television station in Buffalo.
Which is where you're from.
Which is where I'm from. It was really a coincidence. And so they came down to the hotel and they said, we'd like you to come back to Buffalo and just do what you do. Do exactly what you do here. And we'll see if we can sell it. So we did a pilot. It wasn't on the air. And as it happened, it was September 8th, 1974. It was a Sunday, and it was the day that Gerald Ford pardoned Richard Nixon.
Oh, my gosh.
And they purposely, I think they did it on a Sunday, so it wouldn't be. The term news cycle had not been coined yet, but they didn't want it. They thought they could sneak it under the door there and pardon Nixon. And now, so this was a Sunday. I didn't know about it, nor did the audience know about it. And so when we shopped it around the country to the various PBS stations and they looked at that and they said, well, he doesn't even mention the pardon of Nixon. How topical is this guy? Mm. So we realized it had to be live. It had to be literally live, not live on tape. And so I would write things. Maybe there was one show where about three or four cabinet people resigned during the Ford administration. Wow, I got to put that together. And so maybe I'd write a song, and not trusting the memory because it was so late in the day, I would take some duct tape and tape it to the bottom of the lens of the camera. being PBS, we didn't have teleprompters in those days. We had a kid we'd bring in from outside. And he had a Crayola crayon and a shirt cardboard. And so we did that. So it took about a year, and then the show was on. And it was another year I got very, very discouraged. There weren't, there were only about six or eight a year. Mm-hmm. And for a year, nobody mentioned it. Nobody said, hey, we watched your show. Nobody did that. And I thought, well, is anybody looking at this thing? And finally it started trickling in and people said, yeah, you're the guy. Aren't you the guy? Yeah, I'm the guy. And so to this day, people remember it. And there isn't a night goes by when I do a show and there's always a chat with people in the audience afterwards, maybe a little reception, and there's always a guy, and it's usually a man, sometimes a woman, but the common thing is they say to me, my father used to make me watch your show.
Oh, God. Isn't that
wonderful? And that's nice, I mean, there it is. So it's still continued to pay back.
Mark Russell. My father never made me watch you. I just did it on my own. Mark Russell is our guest today. We're going to take a break. We're going to come right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Hearing Solutions Center, offering smart digital hearing aids that respond automatically to changes in the listener's environment. Located in Cotswold, info at 704-912-4622 or hearcharlotte.com. And Bojangles, featuring chicken supremes or homestyle tenders with a choice of fixin' made from scratch biscuit and iced tea. Available all day at area Bojangles. An update on violent protests that erupted in Baltimore following a funeral service for a young black man who died in police custody, efforts to restore order, and ongoing questions about police accountability, victims' rights, and community reactions coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join our conversation, email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org, or you can join us on Facebook or Twitter at WFAE. And a reminder, Mark Russell will be appearing at the Don Gibson Theater in Shelby on May 2nd.
Advanced Placement courses, AP classes, can give high school students college credit if they take those classes.
If kids aren't told that they're smart, aren't given the sense that they're really capable, then they may look into an AP classroom and say, that doesn't look like there's anyone who looks like me in there. I don't really belong.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, Advanced Placement and the Color Line, next time on Marketplace from 8 p.m.
Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Mark Russell is our guest today in town this Saturday in Shelby to perform. I had forgotten about your Meet the Press appearances. I can't imagine a comedian today being on Meet the Press on a regular basis, but you were. Who was the host? Lawrence Spivak? Who was the host? Because somebody needed to prop him up with something.
Yes, and Pauline Frederick was, was on there, too, if you wanted to.
Yeah.
Well, you know who the host was. He was Buffalo's own Tim Russert.
Yeah.
Of blessed memory, and he was very kind. I think he had me on because I was from Buffalo. Mm-hmm. And but one time, there was a dust-up between Al Gore and the Catholic Church. It involved a population conference in Cairo, and it was all about birth control and everything, and there's Al Gore. I'm in the green room waiting, and I'm watching this. And then they went for the other side, a bishop from New Jersey named McCarrick, see. And so he presented the other side of it. And Tim was very polite and so forth. And then they go to a commercial, and I come out. And I said, well, Tim, you've certainly behaved well. You didn't challenge anybody at all. You bowed before the bishop, a good former altar boy that you were. And I remember the bishop had said it would behoove all Catholics to veer away from the Democratic Party. Well, I didn't just say that. I sort of imitated what I use with a stained glass voice, you know. I said, and there was the bishop. You let him get away with saying this, Tim. You said, there was the bishop. I said, it would behoove the Catholics to veer away from the Democratic Party. And I went on like that. And David Broder was sitting there. They went to a commercial, and he said to me, you're going to get so much hate mail for doing that. I said, well, we'll see. We'll see. So I run into Russert about a month later, and I said, you remember when Broder said I was going to get a lot of hate mail? I didn't get any hate mail. And Russert said, you got tons of it. we just didn't send it to you.
It all came to Nebraska Avenue.
So here's the thing. The bishop wound up being Cardinal Archbishop of Washington, D.C., who I later met personally. Mm-hmm. Where did I meet him? At Ted Kennedy's house, which showed me, this was the same bishop who said Catholics shouldn't be Democrat. He's at Ted Kennedy's house, which led to me that the bishops are bipartisan. Come on, you know, they're like senators. They just... They cozy up to everybody. It's wonderful.
Journalists in Washington are sometimes accused of getting too cozy with the politicians because it's a small town. It's a company town, and if you're covering politicians,
yeah. The most nauseating example of that is that White House correspondence
the
other night. John Stewart last night did the best takedown of that thing. It was overdue. And it's disgusting the way they behave. It brings out the worst in all of them. Obama was fine. Obama had one line that I noted. Well, he had a bunch of good ones. But Bernie Sanders, senator from Vermont, who is an admitted socialist, is going to run for president.
Yeah.
And so Obama said, I like Bernie. He said, apparently the people want a pot-smoking socialist in the White House, which means we could have a third Obama presidency.
See, that's what I like about the correspondence dinner, because the president has the best material in the room.
He
gets it from comedy writers all over the country.
There's a committee.
I would not want to be the person that hosted, although I'm told that woman from Saturday Night Live, whose name escapes me at the moment, was very funny this time around.
Cecily Strong. She was good. The whole thing is to prove you're gutsy. And she got on Obama for not speaking out strongly enough on, about ISIS, and she got on him about not going to Paris after the blowing up of the newspaper there in January, the worst part about doing that dinner, and she admitted it in an interview, was to sit through the 2-hour dinner, and it doesn't matter whether it's the White House. A correspondence dinner, or if it's the Rotary Club in Des Moines. I mean, you sit through that dinner, and you really get very nervous because you just like to get on, but no, you have to.
Yeah.
And to sit there watching people totally relax and having a nice time. And that's why I prefer theaters. I mean, the theater, boom, you go on, it shows at whatever time it is, and you go on. You don't have to listen to the financial report to the at the banquet and so forth.
Plus, you cannot upstage the president. So I would think, and I read a story about this, that some previous host was sitting at, I think it was last year's host, was sitting next to the first lady, and he was crossing things out. And she leaned over and she said, what are you doing? He said, I'm taking out the jokes the president just told.
That's right.
That's got to be unnerving to realize half your material is gone by the wayside before you even get on.
But it's awful.
The reason I went into that is because journalists are often accused of being too chummy with the politicians that they cover because it's a small company town. And you, admittedly, would hang around after you got to be famous with these people and go to Ted Kennedy's house and place like that. How do you become friends with these people, socialize with these people, and then be willing to pull out your rapier pen and just terrorize them on a stage?
How do I do that?
Yeah.
Well, alcohol used to help. And I would only go where I was invited. My wife likes to go to these parties.
Yeah, but you went after both sides. You didn't just go after Republicans. You went after Democrats,
whoever. I mean, the thing is, Democrats don't think Republicans have a sense of humor, and Republicans don't think Democrats have a sense. They're both wrong. Mm-hmm. They're both wrong. I mean, they just are. And this current crop is, this election year is going to be wonderful.
This is why you came back, isn't it? This is why you came out of retirement.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be great. I did when you played that Romney clip and I wrote down what I was going to say to you, that Steven Spielberg was writing a movie about Mitt Romney called Saving Private Equity, and then I updated that. Steven Spielberg was writing a movie about Hillary Clinton called Saving Private Emails, and so that's how you recycle a joke.
Yeah, what's your process? How do you do this? Because your material has a very short shelf life.
Yeah.
Because it's topical today, and the news cycle being what it is, it's not
topical
tomorrow.
The jokes I just told at 9:05, they're over now.
They're over.
That's the rapidity. I asked a millennial the other day. I said, what is it about your generation? I said, are you too self-centered? Are you too this? And she agreed. She said, yeah, we're all of that. But she said, we're hyper. And it used to be there were myths about how jokes were written. Remember, it used to be, they're written by people in prison. Well, no. But a flight attendant in New York would hear a joke, and then she'd get on her plane, and 5 hours later she would tell her joke to somebody in Los Angeles. And so that's 5 hours. Wow, that's pretty fast. Now it's 5 seconds. And it's just catatonic. But I don't worry about that. I mean, it used to be one of my heroes was Art Buchwald, the great columnist. And something would happen, and Buchwald would say, I like to wait. I like to wait a few days, see how it plays out. Well, I kind of do that too, but it's risky because of this frenetic pace that stuff gets bandied about. And so there's too much emphasis on the speed. I dedicate a great part of my show against the 21st century technology. I really do. I mean, one of my favorite. What do you call it when a texting pedestrian is run over by a texting motorist? I call it making my day. I just hate it. The only electronic device in my house I know how to work is the toaster. I can download toast. You know, I guess it's upload toast. But my wife does all of that.
Now,
my wife does all of that.
I wanted to test your theory here about the short shelf life and how things are at 9:05 are now out of date. You post jokes almost every day on your website, markrussell.net. And I went back. Here's one from 15 days ago. Let's see if it still has a shelf life. Yeah. Hillary announced her candidacy on Twitter. Well, she couldn't rent a ballroom. What she got against the hotel industry? Real Americans like balloons. That's still funny?
No. No. whether it was 15 days ago is questionable, but it's too late now. The thing with Hillary, that was that, and then she announced, and then she went to Iowa, and so the media just went crazy about for 2 or 3 days. But she's at Chipotle, and she had a taco, and so now they're doing taco jokes and Chipotle jokes and all of this, and it was awful. And now, and I've got the sometimes I'll, instead of writing a song about an entire issue, again getting back to the speed thing, I'll write little limericks. You know, the Clinton Foundation is the New World Bank. Hillary and Bill have lots of folks to thank. If they make it to the White House, it might be said that the Lincoln bedroom is going to need a bigger bed. See, that's that one. And so, and then Hillary. The right wing's out to get me, Hillary. I can't do it without the piano. But anyway, and so the punchline of that was that the Lewinsky years were the good old days. So this is building up. And I've got a lot of things on Hillary. And but no, that's a good example there. But she couldn't run a ballroom. Yeah. But by the way, she didn't go on, she didn't make a public speech when she tried to explain this whole thing with the foundation and the money from these foreign companies. She put it out in a blog. Mm. See, so she was probably smart.
Yeah. Hey, well, here's another one. Here's one from 30 days ago.
Oh.
Which I think still works.
This is going to be vinegar.
No, it's not.
This is going to be a thing in the refrigerator that turned green.
No, really, it's not. Ted Cruz applied for Obamacare, even though he promises to abolish it. His advanced phoniness is... Oh, I blew the punchline. His advanced phoniness is a pre-existing condition. That's funny.
Yeah.
So, maybe...
I call Cruz the dark horse of the apocalypse. I saw him the other day on Capitol Hill. He was walking as werewolf.
Here's an email we got from one of our listeners, Lynn. I played a big band gig in Grand Rapids, Michigan for the 10th anniversary of the Gerald R. Ford Museum, during which Tip mm-hmm. O'Neill vainly strove to serenade Mrs. Betty Ford. Mm-hmm. During the course of the caterwauling, Tip wandered through an amazing variety of keys. In every case, Mark Russell changed keys within one or two beats to match the soloist, making Tip almost appear to be a musician. The band, meanwhile, was well aware of what was happening, and I personally developed a high level of respect for Mark's musicianship. Just before the last note, Mark said, B-flat major, after which we played that chord, making it as if we had rehearsed it. The band had really worked to restrain themselves from laughing out loud. That's a talent. That's a talent.
Wow. Yeah, that's... I remember that. yeah, that was the... Jerry Ford had a thing called Humor in the Presidency. It was an HBO special, and I think that was in tandem with the opening of the library of the museum. Yeah, and he brought in Chevy Chase and Robert Klein and mm-hmm. Mort Saul and all. I think he was bored being out of the White House, and he had a good sense of humor, Ford. To bring Chevy Chase in to do all those tripping routines, Betty Ford hated that. I mean, she just was faking laughing at Chevy, but she really hated it.
What was the best?
The email from the musician, this might have been the same man who sent me an email one time. He said, whenever you play the right chords, you confuse your audience.
Politically, what was the best time for you? Where did the best material come from? What was it? Was it Watergate? Was it Iran Contra? Was it Wilbur Mills? Was it Bill Clinton? What was it?
All of those. Wilbur Mills, of course, the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, who was having an affair with the Argentinian bombshell Fanny Fox, who jumped into the reflecting pool. And that was the end of Wilbur Mills' career. This is a man who writes our tax legislation. And they said, I think, they were in a limousine, mm-hmm. and it was parked by the reflecting pool. And So they said, well, did you see Fanny Fox jump in the pool? Yes, I did. Well, what did you do? Well, we were all in the back seat dancing. so all of those, I think the next year will probably top all of those, which is not good for the country. I'll admit that. But Watergate was too much. It was too good. And then Nixon resigned, and that famous, he gets in the chopper, right? And he raises one hand on the V sign, not both arms like the comedians do, but one arm. And I watch, they play that a lot. Okay, raise the other arm. And there goes the other arm. And the helicopter left. And all of a sudden, I went into a deep depression.
There goes
not
my material.
Because I had to write all my own material. Again,
yeah,
it was very sad.
You have said that we have, well, you have 535 writers, all of them in Congress.
So. That's right. 100 in the Senate, 435 in the House of Representatives.
Mark Russell, political satirist who has delighted people for years now, out of retirement, playing the Don Gibson Theater in nearby Shelby on May the 2nd. It's been real fun, really a lot of fun talking to you for this hour. Thank you for getting up early, crossing town, going to NPR and doing this for us. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Michael Collins. You're a fine lad.
Yes, I am. And the star of my own movie.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. Our producers are Aaron Kiever and Tim Ross. Our associate producer is Alexia Girodi, and the engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about archives, upcoming shows, and podcasts, or to continue the conversation online, visit our website at wfae.org/Charlotte Talks.
And support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Jazz Arts Initiative. Grammy winner Delphio Marsalis plays music of jazz icon Duke Ellington Thursday for a Jazz Appreciation Month celebration at Blumenthal's McLuhan Theater. Tickets available at Blumenthal Arts.